Okay, welcome. Chodesh Tov. Chodesh Tevet. Ebzin. So I'm going to talk about the notion of biblical intermarriage. I'm going to do it by way of three key stories, two of which are clearly related, and the third one is sort of a clarification or a sequel of the first two. And what I want to preface the shiur with is understanding that intermarriage, as far as the Torah, as far as the Tanakh is concerned, is not just a halachic issue. And essentially we're going to handle it as a meta-halachic issue. In other words, as I understand halacha, I think it's fairly clear that halacha is expression of certain values. In other words, it's not just by and large, I mean, there are chukim, and however large that area of halacha is, for some it's very large, for some it's very small, but by and large, I think most have understood, and in my mind it's quite clear, that halacha is a concrete manifestation of certain values. And here the issue is not so much mutar asur, but rather there's a larger issue at stake. And that issue is integration of other peoples and other traditions into the Jewish people. Right? If you want the issue of giur, right? Can there be giur? Right? Which is not so obvious in the tribal world. In other words, modern religions have conversions, but modern religions, the other modern religions, are not tribal. In Christianity and Islam, the largest, certainly the two largest religions in the West, and presumably the same is true of Eastern religions as well, are not tribal religions. It's not about nationhood. In fact, in Islam, there's a very strong anti-nationalist, let's say, and they strike people as funny. But Islam is very, and this is one of the reasons it was so successful in attracting sub-Saharan peoples, Africans in particular, is that there really is a sense of a nation, Dar al-Islam, the nation of Islam, which is a non-national entity. Judaism is not that way. As we know, it comes out of a nation, I say tribal, but the last class we gave was all about 12 tribes. I'm not referring to 12 tribes here, but Judaism in the context of tribal religion has an issue. Who can belong to the group, right? Can there be a process of naturalization? Specifically, here we're going to deal within the context of marriage. That's most commonly the way people have been brought into nations. Conquest and subjugation and integration is also an issue, but certainly starting out, the Jews are not a conquering a nation, right? Certainly up until the monarchy of Shaul, the Jews are not conquering other nations and converting them to Judaism. And for most of our history, we've been politically weak, and therefore that's not really been the dominant way of bringing people into the Jewish religion. So the question is, number one, is there a need for bringing in other peoples, especially through marriage? Number two, is the need perhaps outweighed by the danger of bringing in other peoples into the Jewish nation? Danger for a variety of reasons. First of all, because we're such a small group, perhaps there'll be a dilution of the culture, specifically the religious culture. And within the context of Am HaNivchar, of having a sense that the Jewish people has a very heightened level of morality, that here also there could be injury done to the national caliber of morality if we bring in people from nations with a lower sense of morality. So these are the issues. This sort of frames the topic. And the Tanakh, I think, through a series of stories, comes to certain conclusions. the three stories that we're going to discuss today, which I think move in very clear directions, are the story of Dina and Chamor. We'll read through. Someone asked me who Chamor was before class. We'll read what I'm speaking about. Then the story of Zimri and Cosby, and then later the story of Ruth and Boaz. All three different intermarriages. We're going to step aside to the marriage of Moshe and Sipora also, which also is an intermarriage, which on the face of it is rather shocking. You know, who is the hero par excellence in the Jewish tradition? It's Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Can't be a holier man. There is no holier man than Moshe. And yet he intermarries. Right? In common parlance, he marries a shiksa, right? I mean, it's very strange. But that's exactly what happens, and we're going to try to understand the pieces of this story. Okay, so we're going to look first. We don't have time to read all the sukkim in each of these stories. Certainly, all of Miguel's Ruth would be an undertaking; would be the whole hour. But let's take a look. If you have a Tanakh with you, let's take a look in Bereishit Lama Dalet. That's the story of Dina and Chamor. Again, I'm not going to read all the sukkim, but some of the key psukim. Okay, so the story starts with Tina. I'll give you a chance to open up. V'tetzei Dina bat Leah asher yalda leYaakov leirod bevnot haaretz v'yaota Shechem ben Chamor Chivi nasi haaretz v'yikach ota v'yishkav ota v'yaneah v'tidbak nafsho b'dina bat Yaakov v'yahav et ha'na'ara. Okay, we'll stop. Now we'll read a couple more psukim. Vayomer Shechem el Chamor Aziv Lemor Kach li et hayalada zot leisha. VeYaakov shomea ki timei et dina bito uvanav hayu et mikneu besedeh vechesh Yaakov ad bo'am. Just summarizing up the year and something happens between Chamor and Dina. Chamor seems to be aggressive in his taking of Dina. It's actually not so clear exactly what transpires. I usually understood that she's raped, but that's not really clear. I'll keep shot. There is obviously a problem, right? The Torah tells us, Timei Dina, she somehow defiled her. What that means is not so clear. The response on the side of Chamor is that he wants the marriage to be legitimate, and he goes to his father to try to create some sort of legitimacy for the marriage. Dina is silent throughout. We have no idea what her position is on this. But it continues. It's Pasuk Zion. ובני יעקב באו מן השדה כשמם והתעצבו אנשים וחר להם מאוד כי נבלה עשה בישראל לשכב את בת יעקב וכן לא יעשה. Again, the nature of the problem is not clear, except that there is a notion that the problem is בישראל in בת יעקב. In other words, the problem is not so much, or at least the Torah is not speaking about rape per se, but really it seems to be the relationship of the woman and the man that's most problematic. Furthermore, we know from the laws of the Torah, and again, exactly what rape means in the context of the Torah is not so clear. People have written about this, and more modern scholars and writers. But we know in the laws of the Torah that what happens when a man rapes, if we want to use that word for onus, a woman, so the law is that he has to marry her, right? So here we have just the opposite going on, that if that's in fact what happened, and as I said, it's not 100% clear, but even if we say that that's what happens, then presumably the pressure should be just the opposite, that the Bnei Yaakov should force Chamor to marry Dina. Like, in fact, we have just the opposite. And this point is I think, reinforced in the very end of the chapter. Right, we'll skip to the last discussion. We all know what Shimon Levi, actually, we have one verse in between. I want to read one key verse. Pasuk Chaf Hey, right, where Shimon Levi take up arms. V'yeh b'yom ha'shlishi b'yotam ko'avim v'yichu shnei b'nei Yaakov Shimon v'Levi achei dina ish charbo v'yavo el ha'ir beta v'yargu kol zacha. The third day after this deal, I'm sure all of you know the story, they told the people to, the Jews, meaning Bnei Yaakov, the sons of Yaakov, told everybody, all you have to do is do Brit Milah, and it's a deal, right? But in fact, it was some sort of ruse, right? But what ruse it was is unclear, because Shimon and Levi take arms. The brothers are the ones that came up with the idea. They're the ones that speak out what should be done. And all of a sudden, Shimon and Levi come out of the blue and kill everybody, right? I would have you notice, by the way, that these aren't the natural people, the natural brothers to execute the plan, right? Who would they be? Who would the natural brothers be? Reuven Yehuda, exactly. Reuven Yehuda are the brothers of leadership, right? This is before the Yosef story. Yehuda hasn't completely come out in terms of becoming the leader that he's going to be, but nonetheless, even though he's fourth, we know he has that in him. Reuven is the default leader, and instead of the leaders, Reuven Yehuda, we spoke about in the morning, even later on, being the natural competitors for leadership in the Jewish people, here, it's the non-leaders, Shimon and Levi, that take center stage, and seem to act, certainly without their father's approval, as becomes clear at the end of the story. I'm looking now at Pasuk Lam and Lam and Aleph, ויום יעקב ושמעון ואלוי אחרתם אותי להבישני ויושב אז בקנעני ופריזי ואני מתי מספר ונאספו עליי והיכוני ונשמרתי אני וביתי. So that's, Yaakov doesn't like it, it's not wise, not prudent, ויאמרו החזונה יעשה את אחותינו, right? So the complaint they say back to Yaakov, and it's interesting that Yaakov is quiet at this point, though he has more to say later, as we all know, in terms of the blessing or curse that he gives to Shimon Levi on his deathbed. But it's interesting, Zonah also is not clear exactly what that means. It certainly doesn't mean prostitute in the contemporary meaning of the words, though there are some similarities, certainly. But the emphasis seems to be on achotenu, right? That a woman should be made into a zonah is not a problem. We know Rachav, the Jews have no problem with Rachav in the Haftorah that we saw in Parashat Shlach. But achotenu is a problem. Achotenu, so ultimately, as we'll see, I think, in the development of the shiur, the real issue for the brothers that are most bothered by it, perhaps for all of them, but especially for the brothers that really take it very strongly, meaning Shimon Levi, is that there's an intermarriage here. That this is not really the direction that we want to go into or towards. Now it's very interesting, so you'll say, well, what's the alternative? Right? What's the alternative? How many, Jews are there at this point to marry into? Well, we know that by the Avot, the alternative was going back to the Altaheim, right? Excuse my Yiddish and Sephardi, but right, going back to Urkazim, to Haran, to find from the family of Betuel, and so on and so forth. So presumably there's a less bad alternative. Whereas if there are no Jews around, there's a less bad alternative, and that's to marry with that group of people that are somehow, if they're not full Jews, right, they're at least cousins of Jews. So that seems to be the out. But it's very interesting that in the Midrash, the first source you have on your sheet, there is another possibility suggested, and perhaps the problem here, anybody else need a sheet? No? Okay. Perhaps the problem here is you can do that when you have one child, right? In the case of marrying Yitzchak, you can go back and find a Rivka, and perhaps Yaakov can do it, and, the discussion about Esav marrying Leah. But to do it with 12, the numbers are starting to become too big to continue with the strategy. So what are the possibilities? So it's very interesting. The Midrash speaks out something which on some level is shocking. The Midrash is as follows: V'yakumu kol banav v'chol benotav. That's pasuk in Breishit Lamed Zayin Lamed Chet. If you remember the story of Yosef being thrown into the pit, so when the brothers come back to their father Yaakov, so they say to him, you know, he's dead, and he tears his clothing and starts mourning. Everybody tries to console him. Well, who's everybody? So the verse says something shocking. V'yakumu kol banav v'chol benotav. All of his sons and all of his daughters. So the rabbis are careful readers. They're not going to let this go by. What do you mean, all of his daughters? And so in some versions, the statement here, the question is raised, or the first answer is Rev Nehemiah. The Midrash asks, kama banot hayulo? How many daughters did he have that you're telling me benotav? So hada havat alavai kavra. He only had one, and because of what happened to her, he would have been happier if she was dead, right? Strong language, but not for this shiur. Ela ein adam nimnam likro lechatano beno lechalato bito. What was meant by bat or benot here is his daughters-in-law, right? That's what Rabbi Nehemiah holds, that yes, they married other women, presumably Canaanite women, and they were talking about his daughters-in-law. And we know, certainly, in the word ach, clear, and achot, are clearly used in various contexts in the Torah and in Tanakh in general to mean more than a literal brother or sister. Right? It has an expansive meaning. So it could be that ben and bat also have an expansive meaning. Okay, that's what's suggested by Rabbi Nehemiah. He says that's certainly what is the vernacular. That's what people do. He says, look around, right? You call, and we know today also, right? You call, you know, I call my in-laws, mom and dad. I'm sure, it's pretty common, right? So in any case, this is Rabbi Nehemiah's position, meaning that they had to marry outside of the family, and since there was no choice, that's what they did. Rabbi Yehuda says differently. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lachyotem nasa'u ashvatim. Right? Hadehu dechtiv, yakumu kol banav kol matav, lenachamov yimen, yimain lehitnahem. Okay? So no, they married their sisters. What sisters? Well, we don't know about the sisters, but that's who we're talking about in this verse, that he had not only sons, but he also had daughters. And what Rabbi Yehuda is suggesting is a very strong position, which echoes the actions of Shimon and Levi. What he's suggesting is pre-Torah incest is better than marrying out of the family, and certainly marrying Canaanite women. Right? Yeah. Was born with a twin. Right. 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 That's correct. That's what it says. Now, just a clarification. Noahide law, at least how the Rambam brings it, allows a person to marry a half-sister on the father's side, but not half-sister on the mother's side. Meaning, it works out, right? There's only six from one mother, so that means everybody can marry a sister who's only a half-sister, meaning a sister only on the father's side and on the mother's side. So, again, I'll be technical halakha, we're okay, right? But obviously the halakha, as it's developed, is speaking out a problem. When the Torah becomes given, and that's a problem in the halakha, to marry your half-sister from your father's side also, it reflects a spiritual problem. Rabbi Yehuda is saying that this spiritual problem is less of a problem, right, than marrying out and certainly marrying Canaanite women. Okay? So in any case, my sense, and again, I'm going to connect this with the next story. I think it becomes even stronger. But my thesis is that what Shimon and Levi are bothered about, what everybody's bothered about, but Shimon and Levi particularly and more than everyone else, is this question of intermarriage, of integration of gerim, of non-Jews. And they feel like Rabbi Yehuda that it is extremely problematic, and therefore the precedent has to be destroyed on the spot, right? Reminding us of the next story, which is the story of Pinchas, of stopping intermarriage on the spot. Yeah, Uri.
When we speak of the prohibition of civil sexual relationships, because there's a concept of family that stands on its own. I could understand if a construct can develop if certain relationships are allowed and certain relationships are not allowed. But if the family, the clan, this whole tribe, is in essence an embryonic nation, and the nation and the family are one,
uh-huh.
Well, in the context of a nation, the language of incestual relationship may not be a relevant language.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, certainly we have the tradition that the Olam Chesed Yivane, right, that the rabbis point out that in the very first generation, that's what they had to do. Al Pi Kabbalah, it's actually a very holy thing, and it's too holy to be involved in. Be that as it may, I think that there is still some sort of problematic that the halakha is expressing, and I think that's essentially what Rabbi Nehemiah, the first physician, is expressing. That that sisters are not something we could consider, right? But yeah, you're right. Certainly, there are evolving concepts that are based on certain specific situations. Now, I just want to before we go to the next story, the story of Pinchas and Zimri. I just want to ask the question or present the possibility. Whether Shimon and Levi are of the same mind, right? In other words, do they both share this very radical, militant position against intermarriage and integration of non-Jews? Or can there be some sort of nuance that separates one position from the other? Now, I think I have evidence that there is some nuance. Certainly, as the story develops, we're going to see that their paths clearly diverge. But I think that the kernel of difference already exists at the beginning. You want to say something?
You seem to imply, you're taking one approach, that they didn't want the integration of Shem, Hamar, or their values, their families. Maybe they were just ticked off, and they wanted revenge.
Right, so obviously that's certainly a possibility. As I said, I think the question is what were they upset about, and I think the verses don't speak about rape as being the critical issue as much as defilement, which seems to be more an issue of this. Right. 100%. Yeah, listen, you can take that approach. I think there are more indications that we're going to see that show that this may well be. I'm not saying it's overwhelming proof and that you have to agree with me. I'm presenting one approach which I think works well, but certainly it's not, tightly sealed. There's no room for opposition. Yeah.
I'm seeing that there seems to be like a problem that's exposed here, which is that in the cultural frame of reference, it's okay for the Jewish man or the B'nai Yaakov to marry non-Jewish. And now they have a problem when one of their daughters is like, how do we deal with this? Because we don't want them. In other words, we don't want to share dominance.
Right. So that, yeah.
By bringing males from the outside.
Right.
And especially not when it's like after the fact, now we're stuck with the fait accompli, now we have to
deal with it. Right. Okay. So that's an interesting point which I'm going to keep out, even though it's very valid. Is there a difference between whether it's a man or a woman that's intermarrying? I'm going to ignore that for the purposes of the shiur, even though obviously it's an important variable. Okay, so let me get back to the question: are Shimon and Levi different? Yeah.
Well, I think if you look at the treatment of them later on, Yaakov really treats them the same. Shimon and Levi, Achim, that's the Klei Hamas, et cetera.
Right.
But if you move further on through, all of a sudden Levi takes the up path,
and
Shimon is part
clearly. So that's certainly where we're leading. But the question is whether there were already germs of this to begin with. The Netziv feels there is. Again, I'm not sure I agree with his source, but I think there's another source that points in the same direction. So if you look at the second source, I'm sorry about the source sheet. I compiled it in a hurry, and there are problems, spelling mistakes, and the next source in Hebrew is all messed up, but okay, that's what we have. In any case, he says as follows, quoting the verse, the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, that it says, and we read this verse, right? It says the word two, He says it's extra, and he compares that to Nadav and Avihu, where the word two is not there. And he says it comes to teach us that even though they united in great anger to destroy the city, nonetheless they were two. That is, they were different in the intention from which this fire came. One came from human jealousy for the honor of his father's household, right, should be father's. And this is a foreign fire, Esara, and one came from zealousness for God. Nonetheless, even from such a fire, one has to be very careful in determining its appropriate time and place. Now, I think that Nsiv is presenting too strong a case. I don't think there's enough evidence to support this. But certainly, the notion that they may be coming from at least slightly different beginnings may help to explain the road, which is much more clear in Sefer Bamidbar, in terms of the distinction. Now, the source I wanted to present as perhaps a stronger, I don't know if it's stronger, but I think it's an interesting thing to note, and that's in the genealogy. At the end of Bereishit, if you want to look, it's Perek Mem Vav Pasuk Yud. Right? So there, everybody, all the sons and their children are mentioned. Generally, the wives are not mentioned. The only exception are Yosef, for obvious reasons, and Shimon, who we don't hear his wife's name, but we hear that he has a son named Shaul ben Akananit, right? Which I think is rather fascinating. I mean, it certainly begs Darsheni, right? It's why is anybody mentioned at all in such a way? And of all the people to be mentioned in this way, Shimon is the last one we expect. So many of you might know the Midrash of Chazal to say that's really a code word for Dina's son, that Shimon married Dina and they had this son Shaul, right? Whether you accept that Midrash or not, what is very interesting is that Shimon is taking the lone road. Right, you don't have Shimon doing this and Levi. Well, again, according to Midrash, you could say, well, there's only one Dina, so therefore one of them has to do it. But I think it's very important that the Torah singles out Shimon. I think there's no coincidence, especially as we go forward into the next story. Okay, so the next story is in Bamidbar. So that's actually the end of this week's Parsha. Right, so let's turn to Perek Chafei in Bamidbar. Again, we're going to have to skip through. We don't have time for all the psukim, because as you know, the story continues into Parshat Pinchas. This, by the way, another open question for people to note this week as you're in shul or after shul or discussing the Parsha on Shabbat. The staccato presentation of the story of Cosby and Zimri is fantastic. In terms of finding out what happens, right, we keep on hearing little snippets of what happened into the next couple parshiot. And we never get a full sense, where were the Benot Midian? Did they do anything? Right, so let's take a look at what we do know in the parsha, at least in the first presentation. Chafei, right? Okay, starting with Pasuk Aleph. So it says, "Vishev Yisrael b'shitim, v'yachal ha'am liznot el benot Moav." This comes right after the story of Bilam, right, where Moab was trying to destroy the Jewish people with the curse of Bilam. Okay, and afterwards there seems to be a new strategy to attack the Jewish people. The daughters of Moab seduced the Jewish men, as we'll continue reading, "Tikrenu la'am le'zivchei Elohim v'yochal ha'am v'yishtahavu Elohim." They ensnare the Jews to worship their gods. "V'yitzmad Yisrael le'baal pe'o v'yachal af Adonai v'Yisrael." God gets angry, obviously. And then Moshe is called to act against the perpetrators. And then in the middle of Moshe's attempt to do so, take a look at Pasuk Vav, out of the blue, Vehine, Ish mi bnei Yisrael. By the way, the Hine, as you probably know, is telling a surprise, right? It is coming out of the blue. Vehine, Ish mi bnei Yisrael ba, vayakrev el echav et amidyanit le'enei Moshe le'enei kol adat ben Yisrael, ve'em bochim petach ohel moed. Right? He brings close a Midianite woman. Why? Who? It's completely out of the blue, with no real understanding. Even when the story is all over, we're lacking, certainly on shot level, understanding of what exactly happened. V'yal Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron, a Kohen, v'yakom mitoch ha'eda, v'yikach romach b'yado, v'yavo achar ish Yisrael, al-kuba, v'yitko et shnehem, et Yisrael, et ish Yisrael, et isha, al-kubata, v'ta'atza magesa, me'al b'nei Yisrael. Right? Skipping into the next parsha, into Parshat Pinchas, v'idaber Hashem Moshe l'mor, Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron, a Kohen, ishiv et hamati, מעל בני ישראל וכנאות קינאתי בתוכם ולא חליתי את בני ישראל בקינאתי לכן אמו הנני נותן לו את בריתי שלום. Okay, so Pinchas Cosby, we don't know who he is yet, we just hear that right, we hear that as a man from the Jewish people, we don't know he's a prince, that brings a woman, right, and upsets all the people. Pinchas knows the action to take and puts a stop to it. God is happy with Pinchas' action. Okay, there's not enough time to put this story back together, but for our purposes it's fascinating for a number of reasons, but most importantly Pinchas is, as you mentioned, is from Levi. And Zimri, who will find out his identity later, is from Shevet Shimon. And here also, you have a protest against intermarriage, right? A violent protest against intermarriage. But this time, as opposed to a unified position, you have the opposition moved inwards, right? It's Zimri who seems to decide that it's a good thing, right? Shimon, right, of all people, seems to decide it's a good thing. And Pinchas, who obviously disagrees and shows the violent opposition that we saw earlier in the story of Hamor. Now, what is it, why in the world would Zimri do this? So the Chazal, I think, given the information we have, present, I think, a fairly convincing scenario. This source is the Gemara I have in Sanhedrin. I said the Hebrew is garbled, so we'll have to read the English. And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, quoting the verse, slay every man, etc., etc. Thereupon the tribe of Shimon went to Zimri ben Salu and said to him, behold, capital punishment is being meted out, yet you sit silent. Okay, the assumption, I think, elsewhere, here's not so clear, but here the assumption of the rabbis is that the majority of the men involved were from the tribe of Shimon. The majority of the men that were with the daughters of Moab were from the tribe of Shimon. And it's based on two indications in the text. Number one, that Zimri stepped forward, no other judge. But perhaps even more convincing is the lack in the number of Shimonites in the census that we're about to have in Parshat Pinchas, right? No tribe loses as many people. If the rabbis put two and two together and say it must have been his people that were involved primarily with the Bnot Moab, and that's why we don't see them anymore. They're killed in the plague that comes as a result of the cavorting with the women. In any case, right, they complained to their tribal leader. What did he do? He rose and assembled 24,000 Israelites and went to Cosby and said to her, surrender thyself unto me. Okay, they have a discussion, not so important for us. He then seized her by her coiffure and brought her before Moses. Son of Amram, he explained. Right, Rashi brings this part of the Gemara. Son of Amram explained, he is this woman forbidden or permitted? Right, mutar asur. And should you say she's forbidden, who permitted you Jethro's daughter? Right? At that moment, Moshe forgot the halacha, etc. And Pinchas did not forget the halacha. He remembered the halacha. Okay? What the rabbis are suggesting here that Zimri was doing, which I think is very convincing, is that he's mimicking Moshe Rabbeinu. And the comparison is actually quite strong, because not only is it a Midianite woman that he's taken, as opposed to a Moabite woman who seemed to be more available, right? There's all the Moabite women. We don't read about the Midianite women until much later. Beyond that, they're both taking, remember, Tzipora's father is Kohen Midian, right? Kohen, which, by the way, many understand to be a leader, right? A leader of Midian. And who is Zimri taking? A princess, right? What's a princess? The daughter of a leader of Midian. So I think it's very convincing that, in fact, what Zimri is doing right here is presenting a tremendous affront in mimicry of Moshe. And he's trying to say, you got to be fair here. Remember, we're dealing in a meta-halachic, on a meta-halachic level. The question is not whether, okay, you can say, well, the answer is obvious. Before Har Sinai, right, intermarriage was permissible. Now that we have the Torah, it's no longer permissible. Zimri is saying, you know, that's not what we were holding with Hamor. You know, what happened? And his response is, you know, so you took Tzipora. I'm going to take this princess, and I'm going to defend the position of taking Moabite women, Midianite women. It doesn't matter. I would even suggest that this might be the position that's being hinted to earlier when he marries this Canaanite woman, according to the Pshat, that what he's saying is once we open the gates, either it's all forbidden or it's all permissible. There's no discrimination. Again, marrying Canaanite woman per se, and that it's spelled out for us, is that Canaanite women, Canaanites are the most objectionable nation besides Amalek, and this is at least the story of the genealogy is pre the conflict with Amalek, right? So what I think, the truth is this needs development. It's still somewhat a mystery to me exactly what his strategy is over here, but whatever it is, he is taking the protest to Moshe Rabbeinu and saying on some level we need to reevaluate here. Either you're wrong or we used to be wrong, right? Which one is it? And Pinchas comes along and squares the circle by showing that the zealotry that can be used is meant specifically to do what I'm suggesting that Shimon in the guise of Zimri is not doing, and saying that it's not a free-for-all. Yes, there is room for integration of others, of other nations, but it doesn't mean it's indiscriminate, that anyone can be brought in, and a Jew and a non-Jew are exactly the same. There's no reason to discriminate and prefer a Jewish marriage, again, meta-halachically, over a non-Jewish marriage. Right, those seem to be the two positions, yeah.
Yes, but, you know, it's totally different. Even a meta-halachic position, it's totally different.
Go ahead.
I mean, number one, Moses is an individual. When Moses marries Tzipora, she goes with him.
Right.
So she travels with him wherever he's going.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, she enters his world. The sense you get here with the Midianite women is they're not going to enter the Jewish world. They're all bringing the Jews into their world with
okay.
the worship of their idols. So it's not about intermarriage per se. It's about, in a sense, taking the Jewish men and making them into Midianite men, more than it is about them becoming nice Jewish ladies who are going to bake kugel. I mean,
well,
not coming into Jewish folk here, as far as I can tell. It's more, you said they want to seduce them so they should worship idols.
Right.
It's very different.
Right. So part of it is a shimra. In other words, Zimri can't defend his people on the main issue. The main issue is idol worship. But they say to him, you know, you're our leader, help us. And so he sets up a smokescreen by moving over to the other issue, which is an issue nonetheless. It may not be the main issue at play, but he does have a claim on Moshe according to his reasoning. That's what I'm presenting. According to how I understand the Shimonite way of reason. Yeah.
The answer was very swift, so the whole point was, Moshe forgot the halacha, and Ram Pinchas Ram Masa, the name of halacha, that Arami Baal Aramis, but a pogrom.
Yeah.
We would have known the halacha too if he spent any time in the yeshiva over there. So, if he spent any time listening to the Torah Shabbat, to certain or halacha Moshe Messinai. So, he was, the answer was, now that the Torah is given, you're a dead man.
Yeah, so again, I'm not sure that it's that simple, that it's simply Zimri's and Amaretz and Pinchas' Ram and Chacham. What?
The Sea of Shimon could not be an Amaretz.
Could not, right. Okay, so, yeah.
I think it also resonates with the Dina story because Shem, they say, oh, good, so we'll marry their daughters, they'll marry our daughters, we'll share, you know, they'll move in with us, we'll move in with them, and it's like they'll have a common,
right.
They'll
right.
build a common society, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the distinction that you're supposed to be making here is that, like, they're saying, okay, well, he says, yeah, we don't really want to worship Baal Peor, but it's still okay to marry them, right?
Right.
So it's
right.
like, so,
right.
you know, yeah, we're not going to build a common society. And
right.
Moshe says, but look what's happening.
Right.
But we're just marrying them. We're not going to worship
Right. And after, after all, you did as well.
Enough
right.
with this discussion.
Right, right. Yeah. Worry.
A historically, at least, but the Greek story, the next step of the
Right. So that's where we're going.
Itself, yeah.
That's where we're going. I mean, if you want to, you're welcome to. Say what you want me to.
The smokescreen that you're speaking about is idolatry here. Who are you kidding? This is just a ruse to try and win the battle that the curses and blessings have not been able to accomplish.
Right.
Let's get them this way. And so that's really what's at play. But at a future time, perhaps rooted back in the Abraham Lot relationship as well, it's Ruth returning as a daughter, at least. In the Midrashic understanding, the princess as well,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
seeking to join that
right.
nation,
right.
and Samiel, and kind of
right.
that whole
right. Right.
idea, which case that it's not a smoke screen anymore, and that could be.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to take a slightly different way of learning that story, partly because I think the topic is becoming very big, and one could, in fact, make it much larger, but given that we have about 20 minutes left, we're going to have to keep it rather small. Yeah.
If you take the next story of marriage and Jewish people in Bereshit, you basically have Yehuda going down to Shulchan
right.
Aruch time,
good.
Getting a daughter-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes Dafka Kadona.
Right.
Right.
Right. Good.
And that's the genesis of you know the
Davidic line.
Mashiach,
right.
Which
right.
meets up by the way.
Right. Right.
But
okay.
Yehuda also marries a Bathsheba.
Right, right. But we only hear about it in the genealogy, but you're right. In the genealogy we don't hear it. Yeah.
But
no, in other words, my point is that probably sorry?
Stays in the B'nai Yehuda, like Yehuda.
Right, 100%. Listen. Again, we can make a lot of different distinctions. I'm trying to take a bird's eye view at a very large topic and present certain possible kivunim, possible directions, but there's a lot going on here, and we could certainly bring in that story would help I think our analysis. In any case, Shimon and Levi are viewed at this point as you mentioned before. What's your name, Gita? As you mentioned before, at this point the roads completely diverge, and this is embodied very strongly in the blessings of Moshe Rabbeinu, whereas Yaakov gives them the exact same blessing, the divergence in Moshe's blessings couldn't be stronger. Shimon, again, I mentioned this morning, the Ramban feels that somehow there is a blessing for Shimon, but one really has to read between the lines. It's certainly not obvious that there is a blessing for Shimon. It doesn't seem to be there at all. Right? And as I mentioned this morning also, Shimon disappears from Jewish history. Early in Tanakh. Levi, on the other hand, becomes the tribe of the Kahuna, becomes the people that teach the Jewish people, and the blessing is commensurate. Certainly the office that is given to Moshe and Aaron and the Kohanim already in the desert, but will continue throughout Jewish history, and the blessing is commensurate. That all of this, it's very interesting, writing about this on my next book in Devarim, that Moshe presents a shift in the hierarchy of tribes by moving Levi up in terms of the type of blessing that it gets in a very strong way. If you look at the blessing that Levi gets, and the order of the blessings in Sefer Dvarim, there's some very interesting things going on over there. But that's as an aside. In any case, before we get to the last, let's quickly see the Midrash that spells this out on the second side of the page in the Sifrei, commenting on the blessing that Levi gets as opposed to Shimon. So the Midrash says Shimon and Levi drank from the same cup, got the same curse from Yaakov. There should be a close parenthesis there. This is like in the Midrash says it's like two people were borrowed from the king. One of them repaid the king, should be king, and went on to give loans to others, and the other, it's not enough that he didn't pay the king back, but he took out another loan from him. Where's the second loan? In other words, they both did something problematic in Bereishit. Come the second story in the Midbar, Levi acts correctly, repays the loan, squares the circle of violence against intermarriage to show that it can be done in appropriate circumstances, where Shimon completely blows it. And his kana'ut for his tribesmen is the same sort of all-or-nothing approach that he showed, the lack of discrepancy and distinction that he showed way back in Hamor, that he kills not just the perpetrator, but the whole town. There's no difference between one and another. It's Jews and non-Jews. Either you're on my team or you're on the other. And once we accept the others, we accept them all, because there's no difference. They're all the same. That seems to be what the Midrash is pointing towards. Now, finally, I want to, before I conclude, go quickly to the last story. Before I do, I want to, we don't really have time to read the Gemara inside in Baba Kama, but the presentation over there is that the reason the Moabites were saved, the reason God didn't want the Jews to attack the Moabites, there's a prohibition against it, is because God wanted to make sure Ruth would come out of that nation. So the Etz Yosef asks, I think, a very strong question. Maybe it's not once you hear the answer, but he asks, why do you need a whole nation for one root? Right? We know we're speaking about God, right? Just like the scouts, again, Joshua's scouts can find Rachav and save her family, right? They give her a sign. God doesn't even need a sign. He knows who her progenitors are, right? Tell Moshe, bring them in. Bring them in, and we can save them. So, getting into the story of Ruth, prefacing it, I think that it's no coincidence that you have two nations involved in the Bilam story, right? At the very beginning of the story, it's not just Moab that comes to get Bilam, but also leaders from Midian as well. There seems to be some sort of unholy alliance that exists between these two nations, right? Further, at the end of the parsha, even though, as I said, it's coming staccato, the daughters of Moab are ensnaring the Jews, and right afterwards you have a princess of Midian, and the indication later in the Midbar, the verse is... Yeah, that's right. Right. I have the verse. Where is it? Lamed Aleph Tev Zayin. The indication is that the women of Midian as a whole were also involved either right after or at the same time as the Moab. So these two groups are involved as the bridge nation, right, to the Jewish people. They're both the worst enemies outside of Amalek, and yet they're also the nations from which we get the pearls that the Gemara here in Baba Kama actually speaks about them as doves come from. The Gemara speaks about Ammon as well, but for our purposes, we have Tzipora and Yitro in parentheses coming from Midian, and you have Ruth obviously coming from Moab. So the very same nations that are the bitterest enemies are also the nations from which these important treasures of integration of Giur come from. And I want to suggest that that's no coincidence that and by doing so answer the question of the Eitz Yosef. We said that, you know, just save the family, kill everybody else, right? We can kill Amalek, kill the Canaanites, we can kill them as well. What's the problem? I think the answer is that Ruth, who's known frequently in the text as Ruth HaMoaviyah, needs to be a Moaviyah, meaning that we've all heard the expression, it takes a village to raise a child. We need that upbringing. Is there something about Moav? There's something about Midian that's attractive on a real level to Jewish people. It's not just physical attraction, right? Why isn't Moav that attracts the Jewish men, right? And I would suggest that there is some sort of important national cultural values that must have existed among these two nations that needed to be transmitted to Ruth and that did not exist in the Jewish nation, that was necessary specifically to get not just Ruth from her family, but Ruth HaMoaviyah. And that's the nature of what's being said in the Gemara in Baba Kama, that it's not enough simply to save the family, but you have to save the whole nation as well. What about the enmity, the deed? Why are they trying to kill us if they're so special, right? So here, you know, I quote, I don't know if it's the Yimach Shemo, Houston, Stuart Chamberlain was an English historian who was in Germany, very anti-Semitic. And, you know, so this quote, obviously it's you need context, but he says the Jews spoiled everything with their ominous concept of sin. Why do I have this here? The nations that have the potential to raise themselves to have roots and siporas have a problem, right? If you don't have potential, so you're not held accountable, right? We know, right, that tzaddikim are held accountable because they're on a higher level, right? So I would suggest that in terms of these nations also, the fact that they can produce, that specifically these cultures can produce these great women who are very necessary for the Jewish people, is telling us that it's not only Ruth, right? It's also Orpah. And that there are many, right? There's a fork in the road, and the question is which side of the fork do you take? And the sense of the potential is there, but who wants that potential? And that's what Chamberlain is expressing. You know, I'd rather, you know, live a more joyful life and not be held accountable for the standard that I didn't ever ask for, right? So I think on some level that's what's going on with the need of Moab and Midian to somehow destroy the Jewish people. To, if you get rid of the Jews, you get rid of your conscience, you get rid of the ominous concept of sin that the Jews are perhaps correctly blamed for. I don't know if they should be blamed for it, but correctly brought into the world, right? So finally, coming back to the story of Ruth, which I said I would end, I'm going to just dip into it for what I think is the most important addition to the thesis that we're building here in terms of what is the place of the Gioret or the Ger, but more frequently the Gioret, in the Jewish nation. And what I want to do is point out that the story was not finished with the end of Chumash. Moshe gives a stamp of approval, right? God gives the brit shalom to Pinchas, and Moshe is on some level redeemed in his own marriage. Pinchas doesn't go after Moshe and Zipporah, even though maybe it's because they're separated, I don't know. But
interesting, because Pinchas says Reuben put
there,
and that's, it could be Yitro, it could be Yosef.
Right, so right.
It's bringing it back to Moshe's family.
Right, right, right. Okay. So if I'm correct about the blessings sort of ratifying the position of Levi, that yes, Zipporah is welcome, not just welcome, she is needed. Certainly we see Moshe's attitude towards Yitro is very positive and inclusive, even though I speak about that there's certain limitations to that in another volume of my book. That's not the final word. I'll tell you why it's not the final word. Because of an observation that may be only midrashic, but I think the observation is relating to something that is really there nonetheless. The Gemara in Bava Batra, the last source on the second side, speaking about Yehonatan, who was a problematic character in Sefer Shoftim, he's known as, the Gemara quotes the verse, Yehonatan ben Gershom ben Menashe. Those of you who know the text inside know that the nun is small over there. Hu uvanav hayukonim l'shevet adani. They're kohanim priests in terms of idol worship, or at least using figures for the worship of God, if that's what it was. In any case, involved in problematic behavior. V'chi, the Gemara says, V'chi ben Menashehu, was he really the son of Menashe? Alo ben Moshehu, etc. We don't need to read the proof here. As I said, it's somewhat midrashic. It's not clear that this is to be understood on shot level, that this is in fact the descendant of Moshe. But what this is pointing out is, at the very least, the children of Moshe were not illustrious. We don't hear much about them besides their birth and their existence, right? One would expect, at least in Avram ben Arambam situation, and they're not as great as the father, but, after all, if the Rambam has to have, at least in Avram ben Arambam, but in Moshe, what happened to Moshe? So you can give explanations, it's not Moshe's fault, but societally speaking, we know we have this issue ad hayom hazeh, prejudice against gerim and giorot. They'll say, yeah, of course it's no wonder, right? Look who he married. Right, that's the problem. It sounds funny, but it's true. It's true. There's no question.
With the Midianites, don't they kill the adult Midianite women?
Yeah.
The child Midianites, they all take into the tribe. So they all be.
Ah, so they bring them in. Okay.
They bring them in. They got 20,000 Midianite women coming. As
okay.
Women.
Okay. That's true.
Like that.
That's true. That's an interesting point. That is an interesting point. I was going to say that the what I would answer in terms of getting rid of the Midianim at this point is because Tzipor and Yitro are already involved, but your point is good. Again, there are a lot of loose ends that we at some point would want to tie up. What's the answer to this problem? So the answer comes at the end of Sefer Rut, when we have our next intermarriage of Boaz, who admittedly is not from Shevet Levi. I would have loved it if he was, because then it would tie everything together. But I have a Torah on that, but not for today.
But he wouldn't have the story.
That's right. In any case, the last two verses that we are all familiar with in Ruth, the Shalmon holid et Boaz, Boaz holid et Oved, Oved holid et Yishai, the Yishai holid et David. That the circle has come around, and the Torah, through the further books, through the Ketuvim, through Sefer Rut, has made its point that it's true. Pinchas is correct and is speaking out the truth, the partial truth of the tradition of Shimon and Levi, that there is a time to draw red lines, that one does have to be particular. However, the bottom line is that not only are Gerim, not only are foreigners meta-halachically as well as halachically acceptable, but even more than that, they're extremely necessary, and without them, you not only don't have David, you don't have the Messianic line. Thank you.